Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We're here today on the second last occasion of the SACPA noon hour session. One or two housekeeping items. Being the end of the year, it's a good chance for us all to check and make sure that our annual memberships are paid up. We do go September to June on our year, but the calendar year is a good reminder. In case some of us are not paid up, we may not get the announcements on time, and that would be tragic, of course. So the treasurer will be very happy to see you for that. Pardon? Okay, our treasurer with the hand up is the one who's quite welcome or will welcome your money for the annual fee. At the table, we have baskets, gold-plated baskets. And, of course, that's to cover the cost of the meal. No, it's the cost of the seat. It doesn't matter what you eat. And the speaker, of course, will be thrown in, as it were, for the same price, $8. We collect them at the tables, and then the treasurer will go around and collect the gold basket. Next week, we're going to have a panel, and we're going to look at the question, why aren't the churches so involved in social justice issues as they were in the 60s? You remember they were out crusading and going through the civil rights exercises. Today, we don't seem to have the same interest. We've got a panel of three people who will be addressing this issue, and you'll be receiving that notice, if you haven't already, in your packet. Please make that widely known. It's a very important issue, and it reflects on the conscience of our whole community. I think that's all the housekeeping. Today we have, at our meeting of the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs, a special guest, Linda Croson, who will be trying to address the very vexing issue of what's going to happen in the next 100 years. We have had a whole year of centennial celebrations. We've looked back to the beginning of Southern Alberta and our history, and now we're looking ahead to the centennial of Lethbridge with a view to the future. And the pressing problems is, what have we learned from history? Will we repeat our mistakes? Can we plan well and advance in a way that is in keeping with our corporate identity in this city? Now, these are urgent matters. Every young person going through a university or college faces the question, who am I? Where am I going? What's my future? My grandson's just going through that. But as a community, we also are in the same boat. And so we're looking to Linda Belinda, who comes from the Galt Museum. She's the educator there. And as such, she's an expert in the history of Southern Alberta. She's also, since I wrote the blurb, been elected the vice president of the Historical Society of Lethbridge. So she comes with great credentials, lots of experience, and we call on her now to face some of these tough issues.
I only hope to live up to that introduction. So I am the education programmer at the Galt Museum. I actually have many titles. I'm the program coordinator, program officer, museum educator, teacher, and my favorite, the ones the children usually call me, the Galt Lady, or from the French immersion, Madame Galt. So I will answer to any of those, as long as it's very politely said, of course. Thank you so much for letting me come here to speak to you. I'm most happy to be talking about something other than dead people. I'm getting a little bit stereotyped, so this is a great opportunity to show you the other stuff I do at work as well. And thank you for letting me come and talk a little bit about my job and what I do at the Galt. I'm not going to be able to answer all of those philosophical questions that Roy put out. I have done entire classes at university on that, as well as conferences, and much as we discuss, we never completely answer those. I'm going to talk more about the museum's role in helping people understand their own history and their own identity. I'm going to do a very little bit of theory. Don't worry, I will try not to bore you with education theory. And then I'm going to tell you what the Galt's philosophy and how we're building it into our new building. I'm going to start with two quotes. These are two of my favorites. The first is by Freeman Tilden, who of course is very well known in interpretation. A people who have no zeal for knowing their past are unlikely to have a future worth anybody's admiration. On the other side, I love this quote as well. More of a really silly joke. Those who don't remember the past will spend a lot of time in parking lots looking for their cars. For every person who visits a museum, they come for a different reason. Some of them want to know everything we can teach them about the past. Some of them want to use the washroom. For every person, we have something that welcomes them, that greets them, that meets their needs. One of the difficulties, museum people have it as well as everybody else, we assume people study history for the same reasons we study history. We have to be a little bit more open to finding out why they're there, rather than just telling them why they should be there. So here's my little bit of boring part on theory. I'm going to start with definitions, then we'll get on the same pages. If I ask every person in this room what is learning, I would get a different definition from every person in this room. There is more research done on what learning is than on almost anything else in education. Most people would know that learning has something to do with rote memorization of facts. How easy that is to teach, and how easy to test. I want you to memorize all of these people, all of these dates. If you can regurgitate it all, you get an A, we move on to the next subject. Learning is so much more than that. It's a shift in attitude, in values, and in beliefs. I love to challenge students, especially young students. I ask the students, who's smarter, you or pioneer children? 95% of the class will say, we're much smarter than they ever were. And then I'll give them a pioneer game to play. Usually just the button on the string, and say, okay, this is a game, I'll show you how to play it, I want to see how fast you can master the game. After 20 minutes of frustration, with only probably one student actually getting that button to spin, I ask them the same question, okay, who's smarter, you or the pioneer children? I get a different answer the second time. They've certainly changed in their attitude. They may not be able to tell me exact dates of pioneer time, who really can, but at least they understand it a bit more. Learning is also about thinking critically. I was in a grade 4 classroom in a North Lethbridge school, and we were discussing Southern Alberta at war. We were discussing both here at home and on the war front, and I had a grade 4 student at the end who said the most profound thing, and it stuck with me now for about 4 years. She said, I think it's easier to die in war than to kill somebody in war. This is a grade 4 student. And she might not be able to tell me the dates of the war, but boy, did she understand what we were doing. And those sorts of, the ability to think critically, to me, is very important in learning. It's also developing skills on how to learn, how to research, and how to actually do learning on your own. It's psychomotor skills, it's sociocultural skills, and it's just understanding aesthetic abilities, beauty for the sake of beauty. So that's what I think learning is, and it's so much more than that. So what is history? I've been asked to speak about history. History is not the past. The past is everything that's happened to every person who's ever lived. We cannot do a museum on the past. We would be stuck in little details forever. History, instead, is our interpretation of the past. It's picking and choosing events to tell a story, express a view, or show what happened. No matter how we look at history, it's biased. We are always telling a history. We're telling someone's history. Museums, and anybody who's ever written history, What you have to decide is whose history you're telling. Thank heavens at the museum, we have someone to blame. I mean, help. We always have community groups and other organizations who help us when we're doing exhibits to assure that we're looking at history from more than just one angle. But no matter how you try, an exhibit is going to have a bias. What stories we include, what artifacts we include, what order the story is told, how much room is devoted to what part of the story are all decisions that have to be made. Sometimes the bias isn't even of our own choosing. There are some stories we'd love to tell, but there's just no evidence, no information, no artifacts. It's as if we know it happened, but you can't prove it for the life of you. And if you write those kind of stories in exhibits, you can get sued. So we have to create an exhibit that is biased. I get to make that exhibit more alive. I get to add to the story. I get to be a little more controversial than maybe the exhibits are, because you can say things that you never want to write down. If you've been on my tours, you know what I mean. You can also work with oral histories much more than the exhibits can, because even though something is difficult to document, you can certainly talk about it. And so history is always going to be changing. It's going to be different for each person, and it's going to be different for each group of people. So here I have learning about history. We can't define learning, and we'd have trouble defining history. My job is to make those two come together. There are a few different ways we do this. There's a few kind of buzzwords right now in museum education and in education in general. One of them that we always talk about, and everybody mentions this, is lifelong learning. Possessing the skills, commitment, capacity to learn across an entire lifetime. It's a wonderful philosophy, but how do we make it happen? Well, the way that we are trying very hard in museums and in other resources to make it happen is through free choice learning. Free choice learning is self-directed, voluntary, and guided learning that we do when we want, where we want, and that's only meeting our own needs. For example, did anybody force you to come here today? I think the only one I forced was Lori. She's our volunteer manager. She had to come. I think everybody else, so you probably had a choice to come or not. This is free choice learning, and I hope you will have learned something at the end. Southern Alberta and Lethbridge has a lot to offer, and it's through free choice learning that we can find all this. The nice thing about free choice learning is you're not coercing people to learn. They're choosing to. So what motivates them to learn? Well, first you need a supporting environment. I don't know about you, but I hate pretentious museums. Museums that are just for museum people, and you know there are those ones out there. A museum, any place that wants to be open to learning, has to be welcoming and open. You should feel that it's for you, it's part of the community, and that you can come in at any time and feel important. You should be engaged in a meaningful activity. You should be freed from anxiety, fear, and negative mental state. You should have a choice, and you should have a challenge appropriate to your level. Later on, I'm going to be telling you what we're doing at the Galt and what we hope to be doing, and so I'll be referring back to those and showing you how, well, when we create programs, they actually have a philosophy behind them. I don't just pick them out of the sky, well, sometimes, but hopefully you can't figure out which ones I pick out of the sky. There's a social part of learning. You're not going to be tested when you visit a museum. You can share your ideas. You can talk. Fun, excitement, joy, mystery, surprise, and sadness are all emotions that could and should be considered fundamental parts of learning. Components that take an image and make them forever part of our memory. I am constantly amazed when people walk into the museum. Sometimes it's teachers with their classes. Sometimes it's just regular visitors. They are talking outside, and they start whispering the moment they enter the museum. Stop doing that. Our staff is never quiet in the museum. If you find us, we're singing, we're talking, we are discussing and arguing and debating and conversing, and we want to make the visitors part of that. If you want to come up to us and just gossip, we love that. Mostly it's our volunteers who get the chance to do that. We actually have to do work. But our volunteers love to talk about the stories. I do that when I can. But you have to have a social part. The other part of social part of learning, we always talk about being a lifelong learner. I want everybody in this room to recognize we're also lifelong teachers. Every one of you, when you come to a museum as part of a social group, is a teacher. I don't share your memories, I don't share your stories, but they are as much part of our community history as the ones I tell. So that's why we want to be social and also intergenerational. I think in museums that sometimes we kind of kick ourselves in the foot or, you know, and we hurt ourselves. We have these silly policies where bring a class in, you get one parent for five children, but any more parents than that have to pay. My policy is you want 20 kids with 30 parents, bring them on. Because what's going to create more learning when they go home from this? They come to the museum for an hour and a half. Are they going to be more likely to discuss it at that dinner table if their parents were there or if their parents weren't there? Siblings, parents, they're all most welcome to come along. And one of the ways I know a program was very successful is when afterwards you get a kind of shy and diffident parent who goes, I think I learned as much as the kids did. I had so much fun. Can you do a program like this for adults? Because then I know that they have a new understanding of history, that they may have gone through the old model of history and social studies teaching and come to see it a little bit differently. Museums should be social outings. We had a group of people, and I wasn't aware of how we were teaching our volunteers, but now we make it part of it. We had a group of adults and children in, and we have that River Valley model, the Old Man River Valley that hangs along the one wall. And the kids were up there, and they were standing on chairs, and they were touching it. And we walked over to the kids, and we actually took them back, explained everything to them so they understood what it was made of, what they were touching, why it was important. We never told them they couldn't touch, but we told them what it was. And after that, we noticed they didn't touch. And one of the adults came to me. She's actually been involved in museums and other places. And she said, we were all expecting those kids to be yelled at for touching. But your approach had the same impact as yelling, but made them much more likely to come back because they enjoyed it. So the social part, the being involved, is highly important. This next one is something that is taking over education right now, self-constructivism. None of us, we don't just have meaning, we construct meaning in our own lives. And we all interact with our experiences and knowledge in a unique way. We add piece by piece of our knowledge, we add it in different orders and we add it at different times. So we cannot assume everyone's at the same place. One of the new curriculum changes, they've added the Ukraine to the grade 3 curriculum. So I went in a couple months ago to talk about Ukrainian culture, and I wanted students, grade 3 students, very concrete learners, to understand that for most of us older people, we talk about the Ukraine. And we talk about a place that was more of a land than a country that was constantly taken over by other countries. And I have this anecdote that I wanted to explain about three brothers born in the same village, in the same house, who all had passports from three different countries because a different country was in charge when they were born. And I thought I knew exactly how to do it. I told a story about a man who was born in Lethbridge, Northwest Territories and died in Lethbridge, Alberta. And he amazingly had lived his whole life in the same house. So he was born in the same house and he died in the same house. How was this possible? Well, I thought it was so obvious he was born before 1905. And he died after 1905, so he's still in the same town. Well, the child's answer was, he lives in a mobile home. It became very apparent to me that they came at it from a different viewpoint than I did. An expert and a novice have a very different approach to the same facts. So history cannot just be about facts, it has to be about making connections. I love memorizing. It's something that I have the ability to do. So don't think I'm not doing history with memorization. It's just not the only thing. Memorization and facts are the building blocks of history. Imagine if I told you we were going to study poetry, and I just took seven random sentences and told you to memorize them, and that was your poetry class. Nobody would let an English teacher get away with that. Why do we let social teachers get away with just giving kids facts and telling them that's history? History is about connecting those facts, making sense of those facts. So I'm going to give